Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 708, March 2024.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I am your host this week, Moises Chuyan, and as it often happens, we have a draft roll around that is just too good of an idea not to do, especially when the subject is something that we dearly love, that we're deeply passionate about in all the annals of the oral tradition across space-time. There is one form beloved above most, and that is the bad movie. We tear them apart on Rocket Surgery here on The Incomparable, but sometimes we just love a bad movie so much. There's something that we wish that we could have added to it to make it even more special in all of its glorious badness. So this week we are remaking a bad movie in draft form, and joining me to draft the bad and make it better than bad, which isn't necessarily good, starting directly to my left in the Zoom window, Mr. Cicero Holmes. How are you, Cicero? Cicero, Cicero.
Moises, I am wonderful. What are we going to do in this small room?
We're going to do things the way that Hollywood does them. We're going to plan the course of history with budgets approaching that of small nations. Just around the bend from Cicero is Monty Ashley. Hey, Monty.
I'm glad to hear you said that about the budget, because both of my pitches are going to be very expensive.
Very expensive. Good. I like what I'm hearing already. And next around in the order, Mr. David J. Lore.
I just want to say I prepared way ahead of time, and thank you for having me, Jason. Hang on. Let me remake that. Thank you for having me, Moises.
Well, thanks for being here. And finally, last but certainly not least, the doyen of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. Maybe she's going to anti-ruin a movie. Lisa Schmeiser, how are you, Lisa?
Excited for the opportunity to try to make two bad movies better, for a given definition of better, I suppose. We could start there.
We should figure out our ground rules. So I was thinking we would do two rounds, as had been discussed previously. Everybody has at least two things. David has probably a baker's dozen hidden back there, or at least they'll come to him as we go. So I think we'll start in the order in which I introduced everyone, and we're interpreting this however we want. We are remaking a bad movie. Are we trying to make it better? Not necessarily. We're just remaking a bad movie. If we're going to do it Gus Van Sant style and just go shot by shot and remake Psycho, not a bad movie, and just do Ice Pirates the way that it was done with a different cast and slightly better lenses, then maybe that's what we do. The choice is everyone's. So to kick us off, Cicero Holmes, what do you got?
Oh, man. I wasn't prepared to go first. So I wasn't sure that I should pick this, but I'm going to anyway, because it's the last movie that I've seen.
Recency bias.
Recency bias will allow me to tell you.
But Cicero, Mean Girls itself is already a remake. It's the musical version, but it is already a remake.
That's true. Actually, if we had added a musical to this film, maybe we'll do that. It would have made Madame Web even better than it was, which was not good at all.
I am fascinated to hear how you want to remake Madame Web, the latest in the Sony Pictures Spider-Man Connected Universe, or however that acronym actually works.
I want to hear more about the musical numbers now. I'm super curious.
I would totally do a musical Madame Web.
So,
David, hey, we're trying to keep this non-explicit.
Hey.
Well, So the first thing that we want to do is we want to take Madam Web. Madam Web, an origin story of sorts. Especially those of us here at The Incomparable, have definitely seen our share of origin stories. And we know that in an origin story, you get the moment where our hero discovers their powers, right? And they go through this kind of transformative revelation where they're, you know, usually involves some flashbacks, there's a montage, there are all these different things. Well, that actually happened in Madam Web. And what they did in Madam Web to demonstrate this kind of flashback to give Cassandra Web her understanding of who she was as a character and as a hero was they essentially lifted and shifted an entire scene from earlier in the film and put it back into the film again. So you got to watch this movie in the theater or wherever it was that you wound up seeing it, but you have deja vu all over again. It's like you see the past instead of the future. What I would do in order to make this movie not as bad is shift that stuff. We'll do a Control X. I'm not an Apple user. Sorry, everyone. So I don't know what the Apple command is.
Command X.
There we go. So yeah, duh. And we're gonna shift that and lift it and put it just in that space where the flashback should be. And in its place, we'll have Cassandra Webb as an adult talking about how she doesn't like her mom and how she doesn't appreciate the different things that her mom did because she died.
Just to confirm, that this is her mother who was researching spiders in the Amazon.
That is correct. Her mother was researching spiders in the Amazon. Why did she do that when she was 8 months pregnant? She was very, very pregnant when she was doing this. Why did she do this?
This movie was clearly written by somebody who's never actually met a pregnant person or been a pregnant person.
Or possibly a woman.
Let's keep in mind, science never sleeps.
It doesn't know the bounds of
human limitations.
Right. Some ways, as you say that, really, my chemistry TA in college did actually gestate and give birth to a human child over the course of the year I had her as my TA. And by the time she was like 6 months through, she was wearing like lead-lined aprons under her lab coat because she was so paranoid about the impact of even just ambient, you know, radiation in the lab. And this was a chemistry lab, mind you. And by like 36 weeks, she was basically showing people x-rays of how the fetus had pushed all of her organs up into this teeny tiny percentage of her torso. And my point is there's no way anyone who has to pee every 20 minutes is in the Amazon studying spiders who will be scuttling up her boots while she's peeing. When what they need to be doing is just kind of like waddling around a lab covered head to toe in lead lined suits, making sure that no spiders bite them. Like that's just sciencing.
You have just redefined arachnophobia for me.
Right. So,
taking us back to the Cicero Holmes edit, because it sounds like you're talking about mostly reconstituting the movie that was. Are we talking about also adding things into this? Or do you feel like you had enough pieces on the board that you could chop together and make some sort of an interesting noodle dish out of?
Right. So what we're going to do is we're going to add just a few scenes, right? So we're going to add some scenes in the beginning to give context to why Cassandra Webb doesn't like her mom who died giving birth to her or died while in childbirth.
What are these reasons?
If that woman had not been running around the jungle while in her third trimester.
Right, exactly. Mm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
Did she withhold McDonald's from the child? Candy? What inspired this mother hate from this child?
Right. Well, she wasn't around. And because she died, because she was in the Amazon like an idiot when she was super duper pregnant. Mm. And Cassandra Webb doesn't understand it. And she learns why those things happen in this flashback segment. It would have been great if we as the audience also learned those things at the same time, and gave some it gave a level of understanding and a little bit of an exposition dump for who the villain is and why the villain is a villain and all of those other things. And if they had kept those things in suspense as a mystery for us, it would have made the movie a little bit more intriguing. Instead, they didn't care to do that.
It sounds to me like what you're proposing, I mean, this is pretty radical. You're saying that had the movie preserved a sense of suspense and tension, there would have been a sense of suspense and tension in the film.
It is crazy.
Okay.
But yes, that is indeed what I'm proposing.
Now, I don't know if Hollywood is ready to directly embrace human women being reflective of actual human women in reality. I mean, do you feel like we're going to need an explainer sequence for just, you know, basic physiognomy? I mean, how are we explaining that people are respecting the bounds of human ability?
Well,
pre-title crawl.
What we're actually going to do is we're going to do narration from the character, voiceover from the character, disembodied voice, that will give us more exposition and an explanation as to how evolved these women have become. The other thing that we're going to do in this film...
Tending their young with an almost human tenderness. We think the system of noises they make approximates language, but we're not quite sure.
Here we see the spider researcher in her natural habitat.
Right. Kingdom of the Planet of the Women.
The last bit of artistic change I will make to this film is I will allow the police to do more than just get beat up in the first act and never show up again. A movie that takes place in New York City, mm-hmm. where cars explode in Times Square, and
these are post
9/11. This is 2003, yeah. New York City, right?
Vintage New York City.
So wait a minute, you're telling me that in Giuliani's New York City there were no cops crime?
Apparently. I guess this has to go on the record now, but Cicero, I think I agree with you. This movie does need more copaganda.
Yes.
It's a superhero movie. Copaganda is essential to the basic idea.
You make a very valid point.
Right.
You gotta imagine know the musical are. Number.
Yes. The musical number will be with all of the spider women before they get powers, and it's about how they can't wait to be king or queen with queens of spiders.
I think the stop and frisk patter number is going to be a lot more popular than people expect, and for all the wrong reasons.
It's going to be just like Goodnight Ladies from the Music Man.
You could even have a little jukebox
reference to Officer Krupke and just call it Website Story.
Oh, look at that.
Cicero, I didn't think it was possible for somebody to ruin this movie even worse, but you have. You found a way take that big pile of money that Sony wasted on this and find even more outstanding ways to say that it's still Morbin time. And it's Morbin time inside our hearts. And it's how you live it being Morbin time out in these streets. Speaking of lots and lots of money, Let's turn to what has already been teased for us as spending a gigantic amount of money, but not in a wasteful way. I think in a very productive and good way to benefit society. Monty, Ashley, what do you have for us?
Okay. I was very excited when they announced this movie, and it proceeded to fall flat upon its face. Luckily, I know exactly how to fix it. Pirates of the Caribbean: On Stranger Tides. You may be familiar with it as the fourth movie in the franchise, the first one not directed by Gore Verbinski, the first one without Keira Knightley or Orlando Bloom. It did have Ian McShane as Blackbeard, which seems like a good idea, but it was lousied up by the presence of Johnny Depp as Captain Jack Sparrow. I'm not saying anything about Johnny Depp as a person here, but Captain Jack is completely extraneous to the plot, and I know this because of the book On Stranger Tides by Tim Powers, upon which this movie was based. The book, on Stranger Tides absolutely rules. It's about a French puppeteer who gets involved in pirates and voodoo and Blackbeard and magic and so forth. It came out in 1987 and was a big acknowledged influence on the Monkey Island games, and those games were a strong influence on the original Pirates of the Caribbean movie, and on Stranger Tides was too. So it made sense that they would eventually try to get Tim Powers some money and credit. I was so excited when they announced it as the subtitle of the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Unfortunately, the movie they made out of it stinks. The first three Pirates movies are all a ton of fun. Yes, they are. Watch them again. But this is a bad Pirates of the Caribbean movie that they made out of an excellent pirate book. So my proposal is obviously, just make it again without Captain Jack in it. You can still call it a Pirates of the Caribbean movie if you insist, but that just means it's in the same world of pirates and magic and stuff. I'm okay with Ian McShane still being Blackbeard. We just need to keep this movie closer to the excellent source material, which, once again, the book On Stranger Tides by Tim Powers, which I recommend very, very highly.
What would you say is going to be the best use of that gigantic budget, Monty? What big action sequence can you tease for people?
It's a pirate movie. Putting a boat out in the ocean and filming on it immediately triples any budget. Look at Beautiful. Titanic. Look at the Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Is Disney producing this movie?
Sure, why not?
Oh, so there's going to be a 3D Kraken, right?
Absolutely, there's going to be a 3D Kraken.
There's got to be a 3D Kraken.
I mean, a lot of it takes place in Florida as they're looking for the Fountain of Youth, but sure, we can have a Kraken fight. I got no problem with
3D
that.
3D Kraken, voiced by Johnny Depp.
Nope.
Playing
nope.
Captain
nope.
Jack Sparrow.
Nope. Monty nope. has banned nope. him from the set.
There is no Captain Jack Sparrow in this Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
What actors, if any, are in mind? Who are the box office making names that you want to bring to On Stranger Tides minus Pirates of the Caribbean?
I don't know. I still like Ian McShane. He can still be Blackbeard.
Cool. Good.
As Shandy Jack. Oh, let's say. I have no idea. It doesn't matter.
I think everybody is eager for more pirate stuff. Our Flag Means Death made everybody hungry for pirate stuff again, and so the Sans Sparrow plate of pirate action is our next thing up on the board. Spinning right around to Mr. David J. Lohr, what do you got?
Well, having been there when we came up with the idea in the first place, I can't believe it took me so long to figure out a movie that I wanted to remake. Because I thought, okay, it's got to be something I actually care about, that I want to make better, that I want to spend the time remaking. So I eliminated all the Mystery Science Theater level stuff, because there's a lot of bad movies out there. And I kept thinking then, are these movies that I like that are not great, are they bad enough to be remade? You know? There is a charm to Buckaroo Banzai just the way it is. Or Hudson Hawk.
Yeah, there's
or,
charm in both know. Those movies because they're both perfect.
I love them both. I wouldn't touch them.
Yep, that's why he's only referencing them for reference because they're not bad movies, so nobody could draft them.
That's right.
As All we
right.
know.
That's right. And so I kept thinking, and I came around to The Shadow, which is not my choice, because... Because
this is proceeding very much on track with everything we expect from David.
I came around to and proceeded past The Shadow.
I got to thinking because Condé Nast, who owns the Street and Smith copyrights to all of these characters, has given them to James Patterson to ruin, and he is. And you could say, what were they thinking? Well, they were thinking they wanted best-selling novels, but they're awful. But then I thought, well, now, the 1994 Shadow, that could do with a retouch, but it actually gets a lot of it right. It's pretty good. It's the best film Shadow we've got so far. But then I thought Street and Smith, and I realized there's a movie that is awful from the very first second, and it never gets better. It's a film from 1975. I believe it is the last film produced by George Pal of War of the Worlds and Time Machine fame. It was directed by Michael Anderson, who directed Logan's Run and Around the World in 80 Days. It is Doc Savage, nice. The Man of Bronze, starring Ron Ely, TV's Tarzan. And this thing? Like, it starts off with Paul Frees, whose voice you will recognize if you've ever heard Ludwig van Drake, if you've listened to Stan Freberg's History of the United States Part 1.
Going on the Haunted Mansion.
Haunted Mansion.
The Haunted Mansion. You know, he goes, "This is Doc Savage." And then the music starts. And now, you know, I love adding musical numbers to films that do not need musical numbers. This is a film I would take them away because the entire score is John Philip Sousa music to which they have added lyrics. "Have no fear, the man of bronze is here." No, no. What are you doing? And I mean, the whole thing, it doesn't just lean into being camp. It bends all the way under and through and back up again. It is insane.
It both sups from and refills the well of camp is what you're going
it
for.
Really
David,
does.
For
it
people
is, it
who
is the fountain of camp.
For the, you know, half dozen people not familiar with Doc Savage, not familiar with the entire canon of pulp characters, and mark it off of your bingo cards if you had David Lohrer picks a pulp character movie to remake. I'm sorry, but the bet only pays out what you paid in, because that was the evenest money that in the history of even money. Tell us about Doc Savage, David.
Well, like I said, you know, having taken, I don't know, 4 weeks to figure out a movie, all I could think as soon as I thought of it was, of course, idiot. Of course I'd pick a pulp hero. Doc Savage debuted in the early 1920s, as I recall. He is basically an inspiration for Superman. As the Shadow is an inspiration for Batman, here is a stronger than human who has a fortress of solitude in the Arctic. He is well-tanned. I guess you could say he is bronze. He has a team, the Fabulous Five, who all fought with him in World War One, and they all have different specialties. One is a safecracker, and one is a scientist, and one is, you know, they have their things. And it is the prototype for the basic superheroes we have today. Even at the time, everyone who worked on Superman acknowledged this as a prototype, as an inspiration. And we can do so much better for him. He's a fun character. There are things, you know, being from the early 20s that don't always age well. There are things from this 1975 movie that do not age well. We can fix that. That's not a problem. We can amend that with modern day sensibilities, because the structure, the bones of this thing are solid. I mean, that's why James Patterson is getting to play with them now. These are solid characters to play with. And, you know, why not do a proper, big budget pulp adventure? You know, there's no reason why we can't do something in that sort of in that sweet spot between Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Shadow and The Rocketeer. This fits right in there. And you don't have to have camp. You don't have to have. Part of the problem with this movie is every line reading is arch. It is, I am a heroic man doing heroic things. And the weirdest, even weirder than the John Philip Sousa, there's a point where Doc Savage is famous for having this oath that he follows. This is his code, right? It's kind of like truth, justice, in the American way. And, you know, I love heroes that are aspirational, that have, you know, they know the difference between right and wrong, and they do what's right because it's the right thing to do, right? And that's basically the Doc Savage code. And he performs it in this movie. And then it's followed by a round of applause, not by any of the people in the scene. Nobody moves. No, it is a sound effect of a hall full of people applauding this.
That kind of rules.
It's, well, it does come out of nowhere, and you kind of look going, what? But yeah, it's, and maybe the saddest thing about the movie, it was a movie. It was not meant for television, but it looks like it was produced like a bad TV pilot. So, you know, maybe we do it properly as a big budget film. Maybe we do it as a series for a streamer, because what better than to have cliffhangers in something like this. You know, let's give some proper mystery. Let's have some good adventure. Let's not have really lousy effects. We can do this right. They could have done it right 30 years ago. I don't think they could have done it right in 1975. They tried. But that would be my pick. Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze.
Hey, everybody. I just want to remind you that you are listening to the non-member version of the Incomparable Mothership. We have a membership. It's ad-free. It's got extra stuff in it at the beginning and end, usually, of every episode where we've got stuff to say that doesn't make it in, doesn't make the cut. Lots of other bonuses by being a member, too. You get access to our Discord community, which is really great. You get access to bootlegs immediately after live sessions are recorded. We post the unedited bootleg so you can listen to that without waiting. And, of course, the special edition episodes come out early, like I said, with no ads and extra material. And there are more bonuses all across the network. Check out theincomparable.com/members to learn more.
In the realm of remaking and remaking rules as we're doing them, David, I applaud you for already bending the rules or redefining the rules even by advocating for remaking it as a series instead of a movie in the first place. Before we move on to Lisa, what is the big action sequence that you're spending the whole budget on?
The whole budget. I'd want to have a decent action sequence in each episode if it were episodes leading up to a big, big finish in the end. Maybe in the Arctic. Maybe there's an assault on his Fortress of Solitude. Maybe he's on Everest. I don't know. Maybe he has to ski down Everest. Why the heck not? It's Pulp Fiction. Just anything better than a remote control airplane that blows up. That's clearly not even actually blowing up.
3D Kraken.
Oh. 3D Kraken. Yeah, Doc Savage could totally fight a 3D Kraken. He did it in the books.
Was it 3D in the books?
Right.
Well, it was more because it was all in your mind.
Right. It leapt off the page, really.
That's right.
Like you're a just 3D reading along
and
says,
and then the Kraken reached out and grabbed you, the reader, by the neck. Right. Oh, no.
It reached up out of the page. Yeah.
The fourth dimension is time.
We got Kraken's galore. Lisa, are you taking us back to the world of sea creatures or where are you taking us?
Well, I wasn't aware of the Kraken requirement before I got started, so now I'm frantically.
Everybody gets a Kraken. Played by Phil Hartman, right. Of course.
Actually, I do have a pitch that could use a Kraken, I'm sure. A minor bugbear of mine, and I think this has popped up on more than one podcast, and if not, oh, aren't you guys lucky to get it the first time? I am fascinated by how bad The Eternals is. Like,
oh, yes.
Just absolutely fascinated that you have this powerhouse cast where there is maybe one person I would recast, and you have, like, just this unhinged origin story, and the very existence of the characters is absolutely bonkers. And then you give it to a director who's known for meditative wide vistas and quiet moments of character development. And you somehow cram that into a Marvel template and there's people shooting laser bolts. And at the end of it, there's a giant hand coming out of the Indian Ocean. But like everyone is inexplicably chill about it. Like the movie is just incoherent and it has studio fingerprints all over it in the worst possible ways. It's just an egregious mismatch of director and subject. The story makes no sense and is boring. And if you had wanted to do something about a bunch of supremely pissy remote controlled robots who have to live on Earth for several millennia, you would have been better off developing it as a series for Max. I want to remake The Eternals, but I want to remake it as an Ocean's 11 style caper.
Ooh.
I mean, I still think there's room for Chloe Zhang to do a comic book movie. I think she should actually do one about Karma, the X-Men. And I can get into that pitch later with, here are the movies these people should have made. But my Eternals is an Ocean 11 caper starts off with the one thing that Marvel's Eternals movie got right, which is that most of these characters don't like each other and don't want to be around each other. At this point, they're all thoroughly sick of each other. They are fine living on separate continents and having ranches and art installations in the outback and inexplicable jobs in museums and so on. So you would have to start by giving all of these guys a reason to get together. And the reason is that Sprite is actually kind of evil in this one. And it occurs to her that like she somehow unlocks the secret of who they are, which is, again, basically very intelligent, thin client computers. And she figures out that they can all quickly subvert their programming, work independently of the Celestials. And then she realizes that Thena is not, in fact, having the mad, weary, and the crazies. Thena's hard drive was just incorrectly formatted. So the caper involves them pulling past memories out of Thena, quickly realizing who the Celestials are and what the planetary seeds, i.e. baby Celestials, are, and then deciding what they're going to do is they're going to suck all the energy out of the Celestial and at the heart of the Earth, and they're going to hold an energy auction across the galaxy so that you too can fight the Celestials using their very own life force. And it's done caper style. And it ends with them doing the auction in the head of the dead Celestial that the Guardians of the Galaxy now currently operate.
So the scheme is to frack Celestials and sell them for parts.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm down. I hate Celestials.
Right.
Yeah.
Celestial eBay?
Seabay, really. but you basically, like, the whole point, like, the reason Ocean's 11 works is because you have all these people who like casually drop in and out of both the ensemble and this criminal-esque lifestyle. All of the Ocean's movies work that way. I loved Ocean's 8 for that reason. And if you had something like this where you have a bunch of extremely bored, effectively immortal people who like are so jaded at this point that when Sprite comes to them and says, we are in fact actually just, you know, thin client cloud operated computers, they go, oh, suddenly so many things make sense. They shake off their programming. They realize they still don't like each other very much, but they do enjoy working together from time to time on a shared goal. And this time the shared goal is to screw over the old boss who put them in the situation in the first place. And you know, make a little galactic profit while they're at it.
I think that's beautiful. I wonder, are you planning on recasting? Or are you looking to reuse the same actors, some of the same actors?
I would probably the thing is, the cast was so good. The only one I think I would actually recast is Richard Madden, because I find him really boring.
Who are you going to focus on? Because you know how Ocean's 11 is really like Ocean's like 4 or 5.
It's Danny Ocean and his friends, right?
Yeah, it's like Danny, there's like 3 or 4 guys we really care about. And later on, there's Casey Affleck down at the end of the list.
Yeah.
I would focus on Kingo and Sprite, because I liked the chemistry between the characters and the actors in the original. And Kumail Nanjiani had just the right degree of this universe, to it. So I really like those. I really like the way they play off each other. I also liked his human valet. So I'd focus on those two and basically make them, because Sprite comes to him and she's like, you won't believe this. And she drops it on him. He's like, you know, I've actually made movies that are dumber, so I completely believe this. And so they're the ones who come up with it because they're mad and they're angry. And they actually recruit Makari next, because Makari hates being on the planet anyway. So she's primed to be flipped over to like a life of crime and screwing over Celestials, because she's like, I've wasted the best 600 years of my life just waiting to go home. And from there, it's Druig. And honestly, the last ones you'd get would be Cersei and the Richard Madden boar, whose name I'm just blanking on. This is embarrassing. Icarus, yeah. Like, they'd be your last ones because they're like all boring and noble and broken up and whatnot. And everyone is like, look, we're going to do this with or without you. We've already cracked into Thena's brain and like projected her memories on the wall. It's 8 of us and 2 of you. And they're like, fine, whatever. And they go along with it, and they kind of can't believe they're not running the show.
I love it. We're Danny and Rustying, yeah. Kingo and Sprite. We've mm-hmm. got getting the band together. We're yeah. mixing things up. I love the vibes. Anything else, Lisa?
No. I think you have Salma Hayek in what's basically the Carl Reiner role. Yeah.
Oh.
Yes.
I mean, she can do sardonic. Don't
They're
put it
always
past
up for the same roles.
Yeah. I mean, that's the classic thing. They both walk into the same room reading for the same part.
She was amazing as Alan Brady.
So now
we make
it's
a good TV show.
Yeah, the Dick Van Dyke Show, with just Dick Van Dyke and a whole new group of people. But that'll be the remake, a great TV show draft. So now the pick is to me, and I was already going this direction, but it's interesting what's come up so far. There's some Marvel stuff. There's some bending, breaking the rules of space time and everything. Thanks to David. There is a Marvel movie that is really a Marvel movie only in licensing that we've covered on this show that's utterly terrible and a terrible waste of a great character, and that's Howard the Duck. Now, remaking Howard the Duck, yeah, you could make a movie out of that. But you know what would be way better is a Columbo-style Mystery of the Week show starring Howard the Duck. That's a way better delivery method for the duck with a fedora. You can bring in classic elements of the comic series, which leaned much more heavily on social and political satire, and you just get to have a fun hang with Howard the Duck. I'm also very, very focused on the fact that little people acting on screen, there are still unfortunately limits to the roles that they are offered, and I really want Howard the Duck to be a role that not just Peter Dinklage, because many people think of him first when they think of little person actors, but this is a great showcase for an incredibly talented actor who is just being cast because they're a great actor of a particular stature. And I think that's an opportunity that that Marvel could go about doing rather than just taking an actor of average height and putting them behind a microphone and putting dots on a stunt performer. I feel like there's something to that. Even if there is still performance capture involved and it's not full makeup all the time, there's something about the personality of Howard the Duck that a modern take of using even the way that prosthetics have evolved since 1986, in combination with the amazing digital wizardry of visual effects these days, I feel like you can pull that off and you can make that reasonable, because the existing Howard the Duck in the MCU, I guess he's fine. But as excited as I was to see him, he's just kind of been a little cameo thing in the background of the Guardians movies. And it's really time for Howard to take the fore. And I don't think the best platform for that is a feature film anymore. It used to always be, you have to make a movie, but now it is all about those really great, really crunchy serialized shows. And this is the sort of thing that could have little side cameos from weird corners of the Marvel universe, the kind of thing that would be so fun and so cool that Robert Downey Jr., Chris Evans, the big top tier Avengers actors would give their teeth, which ducks don't have, to be in the Howard the Duck show in just a little one-off one episode cameo.
I'm right there with you, because that's one of the biggest problems with that movie, is that there are so many sides, there's so many tones, there's so many things you can do with Howard the Duck, and trying to do a single story that's just a fish out of water trying to get home is the most boring story you could do with him.
And but, frankly, it's insulting to ducks to say that they have to be like fish.
Yeah. Can I pitch a casting idea?
Throw it in, Monty. I'm always open to casting director Monty Ashley.
An actual duck.
Why not?
We make a tiny little fedora. We put it on a duck. We go from there. It'll be like Lancelot Link.
A whole episode where this duck, Howard the Duck, is turned into an Earth-style duck. And he's still talking. Ooh,
there you go.
But the beak doesn't move synchronized with the speech, like something from the 1970s or 80s would. You just hear voiceover.
Like, hide out with a flock of earth ducks, like all naked and afraid.
He would hate that, which is hilarious.
Well, he would bristle initially at the notion of having to hang around an earth duck nudist colony, but he would eventually get kind of comfortable with it, because Howard just kind of rolls at the punches, as it were.
Well, someone might call him on it and he'd say, "Hey, no kink shaming." Just, you know.
And the show is a platform. So if anybody has any thoughts for the television televised adventures of Howard the Duck, casting or whatever, throw them in.
Right. I have one question, though, Moises.
Cicero, go.
Will the title be sung by Leah Thompson?
It has to be.
It could be. And she could direct.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's a director now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She's direct- a good she, one. I think she ended up directing more episodes of The Goldbergs than any other director by the time all was said and done. Wow.
She's directed several of the new Star Trek series.
Yeah. She's fantastic. She has a deep and abiding love for the material, and nothing would make me happier than series director and co-showrunner Leah Thompson.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So there we are. We got round one. We've got Cicero's restringing of Madame Webb's web. We have Monty's deboning of the sparrow inside of On Stranger Tides and going back to the source material. David has reawakened the spirit of Doc Savage. Lisa has given those, how did she put it? Those supremely pissy remote controlled robots something to do that is interesting, engaging. And we've got a Howard the Duck TV show, everybody. So for round two, I'm not going to go in the same order. I'm not going to go snake draft order. Ooh. I'm going to go draft roulette. And Monty Ashley, you are the winner. You're up next.
Oh, he's mixed it up. Okay. I feel a little weird about bringing a second pirate movie, but not that weird because I love pirate movies. You said, Our Flag Means Death is pretty popular and Black Sails. So, okay. Cutthroat Island, right? Cutthroat Island, I think, was a good idea. It was a gender-swapped pirate movie where Geena Davis played the swashbuckling pirate lady and Matthew Modine essentially played a male damsel in distress. They were both okay in the role, but Frank Langella absolutely ruled as the villain in a bad movie, which he has a history of doing, Masters of the Universe. So in my remake of Cutthroat Island, I don't think we need to do anything with the plot. It's pretty standard pirate stuff. There's a treasure map and cannons and swashbuckling. A movie like this lives and dies with the cast and director. So this one I did recast. So for the Geena Davis role, Charlize Theron sound good? She's been doing action movies. She did Atomic Blonde, Fury Road, Furiosa. So yeah. She could be a pirate. In the Matthew Modine role, I think Nicholas Holt has exactly the vibe to be scared and threatened on screen. And he's already trauma bonded with Charlize from their time making Fury Road.
No stronger glue.
Right.
In the Frank Langella role, it's important to have someone who can project gravitas, doesn't mind chewing some scenery. I want somebody you can like feel their career when they're on screen. And why not gender swap this role too? Michelle Yeoh would be perfect. Netflix just canceled The Brother's Son, so she's going to be the evil pirate queen. For director, we'll try to get Chad Stahelski from the John Wick movies. He'll set up some really fun action set pieces with a 3D Kraken. Why not? According to IMDb, Chad Stahelski, by the way, has directed 4 movies all about John Wick, and he has 11 projects in pre-production right now, so I'm sure he won't mind one more. I do want him to finish Highlander first, but, you know. So that's my pitch, is Cutthroat Island, basically the same movie, new cast members, and a better director than Rennie Harlan.
It sounds like a revival, you know, a common thing in the theater. You put a great cast into an interesting set of pre-existing pieces and play the hits, maybe better than the first time. Some would say that that sometimes those sorts of things end up turning out better and finding a new spin on things, especially with a better director than Rennie Harlan. Thank you, Monty, for speaking truth about a bad movie that has more redeeming parts to it than I think people would ordinarily give.
Listen, I love Cutthroat Island, but yeah, it's not a good movie. So.
It's not a good movie.
And this way I get another Cutthroat Island. I win.
I mean, why not? So next up on the roulette wheel, we're going to spin right back around to David Lohr.
Oh, man. Well, having hit on Doc Savage as an idea, I kept thinking, oh, what are some others that I've always loved? And, you know, this was not meant to become a TV series originally, and it did. And they released what was essentially the pilot as a theatrical film. I watched this as a child. I knew it was bad then. But, you know, we were starved for science fiction on TV at that point. And I recently rewatched not the TV version, but the theatrical version of the pilot of Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. That thing is borderline incoherent. I mean,
sure.
Character motivations shift from scene to scene. Tone shifts from scene to scene. And it isn't even so much as you think scenes were cut out. It's just literally incoherent. And it ends on a non sequitur. And the series that followed was not good. Erin Gray was lovely. The first season was better than the second season. It at least had a sense of humor about itself. And it had Mel Blanc, which was strange. It's just strange watching it now. And so I would like to do Buck Rogers properly. Again, we haven't really had a great version of that filmed. I know that supposedly they're trying to do it now with George Clooney. At the very least, he's involved in producing it, but they say, oh, we want to have him do it, even though he's a little older than he should be for the role. But, you know, he's George Clooney. It's fine. But either way, I just want a good Buck Rogers adventure. Why can't we have that? Why can't we have nice things? Thanks, Glenn Larson. What the hell?
Do we have to push back the century he's in?
Not necessarily. It's still a long way away. It all just right. sounds, it would sound weird. It would be like Space 2099. I'm all right.
Well, ask Marvel Comics. They love the year 2099 plenty.
Yeah. But see, it sounds right for Spider-Man 2099.
Fair enough. What world building things do you want to bring to Buck Rogers? Whether, you know, stuff that you feel like the original got wrong or stuff that you just, that this is how you would see the 25th century.
I would actually do basically the plot that they do. You know, he's found in the future, but it turns out he's found by the bad guys. It's kind of like, you know, what if Superman, what if Kal-El had landed in 1920s Russia, right? He is found by the Draconians. The Earth forces are suspicious of him. He has to prove himself to them. That's a pretty solid story they started with. I would just make it coherent. I would have a better plot to have improve his worth. I would not reuse props and special effects from the 70s Battlestar Galactica. Just little things like that. It would not be a major realignment of at least the setup. The second half of that story, yeah, you're going to do a better story. But you can see where they had good ideas and they just made bad choices with them.
So who would you cast? Do you have names in mind?
I don't really know. I haven't even thought that far ahead.
I mean, you mentioned Clooney, you know, being Clooney. What do you, if you put Clooney in this, or do you put opposite him?
Well, you want to have someone comparable.
Age appropriate.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
What about Elizabeth Banks?
Oh, she'd be great. She would be great.
Why do the heroes of everything have to be 25 years old?
She's good at being wry and
she'd
flinty.
Be so impatient. Yes,
and that would fit with mm-hmm. Wilma.
Will there be a 3D space Kraken?
We can do a 3D. They basically did an episode that had that. So yeah, absolutely. All right. Everybody gets a Kraken?
Then I'm approved. I approve.
I'm all right.
This is coming together.
Buck Rogers, 25th century, coming up fast.
Just, coherent.
Just coherent. That's always a good note.
That's all I ask.
Yeah. you know, fix a bad movie. Make sure you have it coherent first. Up next, the roulette wheel spins around to Lisa Schmeiser.
Ah, back to me, I see. Okay. Keeping just as Monty did two different pirate movies, because Monty loves pirate movies. I'm doing two different comic book ensemble movies, because I love comic book movies and ensemble movies, and I love critiquing them. So with that prelude, let me start. I enjoy X-Men movies. I do. I acknowledge that there is not a single perfect one, but as somebody who has loved the series since the Chris Claremont days and loves many of the spinoff series, I find it exciting on like a core memory type level to see, oh, this is what Wolverine looks like in 3D. And now we've got Rogue. It's all, oh my God. I just really love it. Right. Here's the thing though. I hated the New Mutants movie with the Fire of a Thousand Suns.
I just want to bet with myself.
I bet you did. Hated that movie. First of all, the Demon Bear Saga is not for X-Men newbies. It is intermediate level X-Men. You have to have gone through the whole new X-Men series to get to the point where you understand why the Demon Bear Saga is such a big deal and why it's so pivotal to the development of Danny Moonstar. And when you have this, I'm going to spoil this movie. You guys won't care. No one cared about this movie when it came out anyway. So to be like, ooh, it's what if we put five teenagers in a hospital and we called it a school and it was unsettling and you couldn't trust authority figures and it was vibing Stranger Things and there's like a little cast overlap and there's a demon bear because someone terrible movie. So here's what and it got me thinking about X-Men movies in general and what would I change about all of them other than, you know, casting choices and the storylines and the special effects. And here's the thing. I don't like the high seriousness that infuses them. Like they always play off Charles Xavier and the mansion and the school and the staff, they're all such drags. They are like perpetually like intent of purpose and they may make wry quips, but nobody has a sense of humor. And everybody takes themselves and the world and philosophical debates extremely seriously. And it makes these characters feel very, very removed from what they are in the comic books. And in the comic books, good X-Men writers always center the character's humanity. And they point out, sure, they're bright blue and go, and there is a whiff of sulfur every time they teleport someplace. But they are complex and human and have the same thoughts and feelings and the same yearnings for universal experiences as all of us. That's like a strength of the comic books. That's something that doesn't come across in the movies because you've got Charles Xavier, you know, wheeling around in his wheelchair. he's a very powerful mutant and all that nonsense. And it's just, it's dull, D-U-L-L, dull. So what I think you need, and the other thing I really dislike about these movies is even when you go into Xavier's mansion, like half of the people who live there and work there are always wandering around in wide-eyed wonder, like the first-year students at Hogwarts. You know, ooh, look at that. There's a child who turns invisible when they're embarrassed. Well, wonders never cease. Like, no, high seriousness, boring naivety. It's terrible. The school is always seen as, oh, it's this special serious place. Everybody thinks that's special every day of the week. And the truth of the matter is that real people, and especially teenagers, really don't spend that much time like marinating in existential appreciation for their circumstances. You know, they're human beings. They're messy. They're inside their head. They're really focused on stuff that seems small but is super important to them, like who they're going to sit next to in class and things like that. And with this long, windy prologue, my pitch for remaking the New Mutants is make it like it's Meatballs.
Ah, wow. That is, it rated is R? Great. That's great.
Like they just have to be dumb teenagers. And I'm not saying that teenagers are stupid. I'm saying that like when your prefrontal cortex is still busy developing and you have no impulse control and you have no experience to draw from, you're going to do stupid stuff because you don't know that it's dumb. And we need a movie where like it is a summer camp atmosphere and these teens are just completely wrapped up in like all of the petty drama and low stakes but incredibly important things that happen. And you've got a couple mutants who are like left out, and it's not because they're like hideous blobs with visible internal organs or, you know, like weird freaky bird people. It's just they're unpleasant to be around or they're socially awkward or whatever. And you have all of that going on. They're not like, oh, we have to train to make sure we're not killed by sentinels. It's stuff like, we need to make sure you guys can swim. Let's go. And while all of this is going on, of course, you also have parallel plots where the like actual senior X-Men are basically your camp counselors. And their stuff they're doing is just as dumb. It's just dumb on an adult level. Like, we find out that Cyclops has never filed taxes, for example. Or... And Jean Grey is like, I can't live with somebody who can't put down a security deposit because he says that he's a sovereign citizen. Scott, it's not going to work out. Like,
when you said like, that teenagers spend a lot of time in their heads, I was hoping you were going to make a movie of that Legion issue where they all go inside his head.
Oh, man. Oh, that's a missed opportunity I didn't take. Oh, man. No, I just thought, what if Meatballs but with mutants? I thought that'd be really fun because you would see them as people. Uh-huh.
And I'm seeing, you know, Charles Xavier, Bill Murray.
Wow.
Oh, my God. Yes. So, that's perfect.
Right? So, Lisa, in this wet, hot, mutagenic summer that you've put together, who else are we casting aside from Bill Murray as Professor Charles Xavier?
Or Will Arnett.
With a straight
Will
face.
Will Arnett.
Will Arnett as Cyclops could be amazing.
Oh, my God. Because Cyclops is basically Job. Oh, yes.
Yeah, all the X-Men should be way older than we think of them as being, because to all teenagers, anyone over 20 is very, very old.
So you may as well like lean into it and cast middle-aged people.
I mean, it works for high school movies, casting middle-aged people.
Right. That's true.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. To be honest, I hadn't gotten as far as casting. I was just going to spend my time persuading you all this was a good idea. So
let's talk characters.
Oh, you knew we'd be all in on that.
Characters who are in this yeah. Professor X, Cyclops. But let's talk about Jean Grey. Let's talk about New Mutants and non-typically New Mutant characters that you want populating this thing.
You have to have like all of the Guthries. Like, one of the running jokes in the movie is going to be that there's a new Guthrie sibling in every scene.
Well, you know that one. He's nigh invulnerable when he's blasting.
Yeah, because there's Sam, there's Paige, there's like a couple others. There was like this period in the early aughties where like every time you picked up a new X-Men spinoff series, there was like a new Guthrie with some sort of power. So like one of the running jokes is you have Sam, you get introduced to Cannonball, and then you get introduced to Husk, and then like they just keep coming. And by the end of it, there's an entire cabin that's nothing but Guthries and people sleeping in a meadow. How did that happen?
The Weasleys of the X-Gene.
Yes, that's perfect. Yeah, so you have that, obviously. You have to have Sunspot, Roberto Da Costa, as like the snobby rich kid who thinks he should be going to Magneto's camp across the lake. Because that's where like the rich kid mean mutants go. And of course, Emma Frost is like the head camp counselor there. And she absolutely positively hates Charles Xavier for his freewheeling fun camp style. And I don't see why January Jones can't reprise that role. She's got really good comedic timing.
And she could say freewheeling and Charles could just stare at her. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Really?
Yes. Yes. So let's see, continuing our New Mutant thing, you have to have Danny Moonstar as one of the junior counselors. Of course, Rain Sinclair is the camper that wets the bed.
Wow, you're giving Rain lots of additional levels beyond the trauma that she already has to deal with.
Well, yeah, like she's the one, like her whole story arc in the movie is clearly going to have to be the one where a counselor takes them, like she becomes like the counselor's project and like they do macrame lanyards in the woods together or some nonsense like that. And by the end of it, when people are still making fun of her for peeing in the bed, what she does is she confidently shifts into werewolf form and then like lifts her leg and pees on them. And that's played for laughs.
It's a new Disney. It's all possible.
It's a rated R teen camp comedy. It will not be available on Disney Plus in any country.
Tell me Gambit is a camp counselor.
Yeah, because you have to have Rogue. They have to be the two counselors that are constantly making out.
Yeah, but Rogue is legal in 14 states.
Yeah.
I can give the kids some herbal refreshment.
It not you. It Rogue.
Yeah. Now you have to keep some, like, I think if you have Wolverine there, first of all, he has to be played by somebody who's Danny DeVito-esque, if not Danny DeVito himself.
Danny DeVito himself.
Because what we tend, like, everyone, when they think Wolverine, they're like, ooh, Hugh Jackman, because, like, it's an indelible screen role and he's been in so many of the films.
But why does Wolverine look like a 6 foot tall Australian?
And we all tend to forget that in the books, he's this short, incredibly hirsute little Canadian man. And Danny DeVito, I don't believe is Canadian, but short in hirsute definitely fills the role. And having them do like the fastball special would be amazing.
I love the idea of them just doing this, you know, what if style, where it doesn't have to tie into any of the big interconnected continuity of things. It's just, you know, just a movie to have fun. We're having
fun. Like, people get really annoyed by Dazzler. Yeah, people get really annoyed by Dazzler for constantly doing the fireworks thing and singing because she's like this overdramatic theater kid. And she hangs out with Jubilee and they're frenemies in a Mean Girls kind of way because they both have like the whole lights and pyrotechnics thing going on.
And then, of course, something goes wrong and the 4th of July fireworks don't work. And they all look at her and she's like, I tried. I don't know what happened.
I'm too drunk. I mean, just.
Dazzler got drunk and was found passed out on a tree stump.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's like, this is the thing, is there's not, like, when the closest thing you get to levity in any X-Men franchise comes in the cartoons, like, there's just a lot of opportunity you're leaving on the table here to do something where, instead of it being, you know, we mutants are humans too and we love humanity, like, show them being messy, disastrous, hilarious human beings who happen to be mutants, or, like, you know, where it's no different than, you know, having an insanely good tennis serve or perfect pitch or something like that.
Lisa, I know, like me, you enjoy those annual issues where the X-Men or the Avengers would play softball or something like that.
I see them
directly taking as inspiration the baseball scene from the first Twilight movie. And doing that, but with these incredibly messy teenagers. I think you've built a series of canvases for them to paint with. This could be the highest grossing kids sneaking into R-rated movies movie in decades.
You did it.
All right, we did it.
One of the new mutants is a 3D cracker.
Even Scorsese would say that's cinema.
Kristen
cinema, but still.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know why I'm mentioning this, but if you like the sound of X-Men things and the season that is the summer, maybe it'll be an interesting year for folks here on The Incomparable. Before I give too many other things away, Cicero Holmes, now that we've saved cinema, how are you going to doom it once again?
Oh, man. I am so happy that there have been lots of comic book movies and comic book franchises that we've talked about, much like Lisa. This is a comic book movie, much like Lisa's. This is an ensemble piece. Unlike Lisa, I don't hate this with 1,000 Suns, the intensity of 1,000 Suns. I don't, but it was bad. Really, I only have one thing to say to you all, and that is, my movie is, why did you say that name? Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah.
Re-envisioning the Martha verse, Cicero. Yes. Very ambitious.
Yes.
I feel like a Kraken is on its way, maybe.
So not only will I save this film, but I will save the DCEU with this film. So for the three of you that have not seen this film, Batman and Superman have beef, and instead of talking about it like mature adults. They decided to have a fight. And then Lex Luthor, it was goofy and he's young, but he was running Facebook, but now he's Lex Luthor. And then he like gets Zod and turns Zod into another Superman villain who winds up killing Superman. And that's the end of the movie. And everyone's really sad. That movie was dumb. So let's make it less dumb. We can have Batman v Superman, but this is what we have. In the beginning of the film, we have Clark Kent in the Daily Bugle talking to Perry White, or they're kind of discussing in the bullpen who is going to go to Gotham City to follow the story of Robin being missing, Batman's sidekick. And as they're determining that, we cut across the bay to Gotham City, and we see, which of course is nighttime now because it's Gotham, we see Batman chasing down goons. It's kind of the same scene that we see in the beginning of BVS, where he's in a tenement house and he's beating up people and he's trying to find out where the Joker is, because the Joker has Robin and he needs to find out where Joker is and figure out exactly what's going on so he can discover where Robin is. We flash back to why Batman is not on the ball. And that is when we get the scene from Man of Steel where Superman is fighting Zod and they're destroying Gotham or Metropolis. No one really knows what city it actually was at the time. But we get that whole scene where Ben Affleck as Bruce Wayne is expertly driving one of the worst cars ever made in the Jeep Compass around whatever that city is, as buildings are falling and people are dying and all of this stuff. And Batman is obsessed with the fact that these gods live amongst them. And he is focused on how the best stop this. Then we realize what we learn is that Batman was so focused on how to stop Superman that he wasn't paying attention to Robin as he went on this terrible mission where it was obvious that it was a trap for Joker. Flash forward, Joker kills Robin, and Batman is beside himself with rage. So much rage. And we learn this through different information and you know, news reports and stuff like that. But Batman is in such rage that he tries to kill Joker at the courthouse where he's being tried for the murder of Robin after he's been brought to justice. And much like they have in Death of the Family, the comic book, Superman stops Batman from entering the courthouse. And that starts the beginning of their beef. Superman now looking at Bruce Wayne and looking at Batman says he needs to be stopped because he's more than a hero. He's a vigilante and he's going to take he's going to take lives into his own hands because he's beset by rage. And that starts their internal beef. Well, while that's happening, Lex Luthor goes to Gotham City where the remains of Zod is and not being challenged by Wayne Corp because Bruce Wayne is so focused on stopping Superman and he's using his resources from Wayne Corp to figure out how to best stop Superman. Lex Luthor and Luthor Corp is able to come in, scoop in, get Zod, do all the things, create the monster and start to create the monster that is Doomsday. And what we now have is Batman versus Superman in this colossal argument over who is more dangerous for humanity. And then they wind up having a fight that is stopped by Wonder Woman because she's the voice of reason between the two of them. And they realize there's an existential threat that is Doomsday that comes in, he fights, then Superman goes and he sacrifices himself by flying up into the air and then coming down onto the ground, and they both die, and that's the end of the movie. There we go. We've got a beautiful movie where we've saved it and nobody has to say a stupid name. We've got Wonder Woman in there to save things, and we've got hope for the future because there's a daisy that rises on the grave of Clark Kent.
Now, Cicero, I mean, are we subtitling this Batman versus Superman Beef of Justice? What are we calling this remake of the movie?
Batman versus Superman. You know what? What we're going to do is we're going to do Batman versus Superman Death in the Family.
I just want to say, you're leaving money on the table because Denny's could have a Beef of Justice menu.
Oh, yeah. Well,
be amazing. You know what? Yeah, we don't have to name the movie that. Denny's can do what they want with the tie-in menu.
That's true. That is true.
So who are we, or do you have people in mind who we would cast in this as
well? I think the casting was not even close to the problem with that movie. I think the casting of a worn down Ben Affleck, just a jaded Bruce Wayne played by a disaffected Ben Affleck, was perfect. And you know, art imitating life. If you've seen Ben Affleck recently, sometimes you can get everything you want.
What we are missing is an actor playing Robin, because there was no Robin in that Batman no versus Robin Superman original. Who's our Robin for this?
So it is. This is going to be a younger actor, because it won't be much of a
You could have Chris O'Donnell as Nightwing and then have a younger Robin.
You could, but then you're adding Nightwing.
If I can make a small pitch. We just watched The Holdovers. And the actor
Paul Giamatti
who,
as
Paul
Robin,
Giamatti would be amazing.
No, I was not. Although Paul Giamatti needs to play a supervillain. The actor who plays the young, I would say second on the call sheet or second protagonist, is Dominic Sessa. He's fantastic.
He could be
a great Jason Todd.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh man, yeah. I hate Jason Todd. So
he'd be a better Dick Grayson.
Yeah, I think if you had this appealing, brainy, lanky, vulnerable Robin, somebody where you could understand why he's really, really open and empathetic and idealistic, and Batman is like, oh, you're like me before everything. And we all have dead parents. Like, I think you could really get into this Robin and be rooting for him. So when he dies, it's absolutely devastating. You know, you really want to rip out everyone's heart with this so that you understand why, you know, the narrative propulsion is as urgent as it is. So Dominic Sessa.
The reason I suggest Nightwing is only because, you know, to have a death in the family, you got to have more than Loner Batman. And you can have him with this obsession of Robins don't die, because
only thing I'd push back is Chris O'Donnell is a generational peer to Ben Affleck. Right. We need kind of a millennial Robin.
No, you need someone younger.
Right. Yeah. I think you need to cast an actor who's just hitting their 30s.
I would actually cast Noel Fisher from Shameless, who played Mickey Malkovich.
Oh, okay.
So would you cast him as like non-dead Robin, or would you cast him as dying Robin?
I would cast him as Nightwing. If we're going to add a Nightwing to this cast, then
I'm for it.
Yeah. Which we could add, right? So we could have Nightwing siding with Wonder Woman to prevent the mega fight that we're bound to have.
And that adds even more conflict for Bruce/ Batman.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Because here is someone that he has a connection with, that we know he has a connection with.
So is there any room in this movie for a cameo from Grant Gustin as the Flash?
I mean, there should be.
There should be.
Well, absolutely.
Because we need to have a
It'll
better
be
flash.
Fast.
America deserves a good flash.
Well.
Well, hey. Yeah, so that is I think we can do it. We can do this. We've got the know-how, we've got the talent. Mm-hmm. And,
we have the technology.
Yeah, we do have the technology. So, we can get rid of this contrived reason for these two fighting and contrive a new reason for the two of them to fight, which is that both of them are worried about the other one losing control as a result of watching the two of them fight, battle their literal and metaphorical demons. In front of the world. And neither of them understand the magnitude of their particular demons because they're so used to dealing with those on their own, even amongst their team. There you go, Zack Snyder. That's a free one that you wasted.
Batman versus Superman, death of the family. I've got one more, and then we'll do a quick bring out your dead lightning round, spin it all the way around the wheel. You know, as adaptations of beloved childhood or toy-based franchises go, there have been a lot of missteps along the way. And one of them, the title, to me, felt like it had a grander sense of adventure, even though that was technically the name of its franchise, then they delivered with some, I think, more interesting than they were given credit for, MacGuffin elements, plot elements, that sort of thing. They could have done so much more. Because the thing that I think about looking at various companies that now own different toy brands and everything, they're constantly trying to make fetch happen with Visionaries or Mask or various different things. So what I think is kind of the Super Smash Brothers version of bringing together a bunch of different 80s-ish children's toy brands into one big toy box adventure is to remake Masters of the Universe. Because Masters of the Universe used a cosmic key that bridged dimensions. So rather than just go somewhere and have an adventure with Courtney Cox and her boring boyfriend, which had its highlights and some interesting bits and Gwildor learning what chicken wings were like, I think using that cosmic key is a way to bridge multiple realities, that of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, of the G.I. Joes, of all of those different toys that for some reason made more sense in the Reagan era than they do in trying to make them work time after time after time. Let our heroes jump across bridges to different dimensions and collect different people along the way. Something more akin to the vibe of Dungeons and Dragons Honor Among Thieves. But instead of collecting different adventurers from within the Dungeons and Dragons world, collecting different adventurers from these disparate realities. And I'm not especially particular about, you know, which G.I. Joe character they bring along or which guy from Mask they grab or,
Which My Little Pony? Because it's also Hasbro.
My Little Pony. Why not? You could even jump over to the Wild West Cowboys of Moo Mesa. There are so many different options that allow you to do something akin to the wild amount of impossible different dimensions that you see in something like the Spider-Verse movies, with a bunch of IP whose corporate masters have just not figured out a way to ignite them. For this, I would have Lord and Miller directing, producing, writing, and as He-Man, I feel like, I don't really care who they cast as He-Man. I almost want He-Man to be a supporting character in his own movie. And kind of poke fun at his lawful goodness a bit. And let He-Man not have to carry the weight of the whole thing on his shoulders. But he is an entertaining, good-natured, good-hearted barbarian warrior, heir to a throne, who doesn't have to play the exact same hits of what I think Kevin Smith's done actually a very good job in animation, continuing and completing the story of those He-Man cartoons for Netflix. Let's find something different to use the character for than just do the same story over and over again, if only to find a reason to have the Transformers fight the GoBots or something. Any thoughts, yeah. Any notes, any toys that need to go in the toy box?
Will they be driving Hot Wheels?
They can. Oh, they absolutely can.
Think, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I like this.
Yeah, no, you can play with all the Mattel and all the Hasbro stuff. Have Strawberry Shortcake. Have maybe not Rude Dog, but at least one of the dweebs.
Is it animated?
Live action with gigantic amounts of visual effects. The most expensive movie ever made.
Oh, all right. I mean, nothing could possibly go wrong with this.
Nope, nothing.
We can call it the Homer.
No studio meddling could sink Masters of the Universe,
Ready Player One,
Infinity Crisis Quest on infinite
is
dimensions.
Magic. Don't forget, is magic.
Is you magic. There we go.
Yes. Why is this? You might have just saved Hasbro.
Somebody has to. Somebody has to.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
All right, so let's do one more quick round around. If we have any Bring Out Your Dead stuff, let me start with David because I know that he's got a couple.
And as promised, I did add as we were going on.
Did anyone doubt?
No, God, no. Well, you know, again, it's like, oh, that's, oh, yes, Nat, add that. I almost chose this instead of Buck Rogers, but the 1980 Flash Gordon. The only reason I didn't, you've got Brian Blessed. That's just gold right there. But yes, I would like to do Flash Gordon better. I would like to do the 2011 Green Hornet, which, what in God's name? I would actually do Buckaroo Banzai only to give the same people a much bigger budget so they could do it the way they wanted to do it. I would do Having Wonderful Crime, a film from the 1940s that was an adaptation of the novels of Craig Rice, and it is awful, and we need better adaptations of her books. I would do Batman and Robin because I kind of liked George Clooney as Bruce Wayne. I'm okay with him. Everything else can go. I would do The Shadow and get the other 25% of it that they got wrong right. This is an idea that I should say, it's basically a Phil Michaels idea, but I have thought about it ever since he said it 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Basically, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, except it's Ocean's 11 / Hudson Hawk in Sherwood Forest. And finally, I would take Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I would make it not exist because I want to see Indiana Jones and the City of the Gods with the script by Frank Darabont. That would have been a good movie. That would have been the coherent version of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
That is what's in the space between spaces.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, mm-hmm. You will be hearing from Phil Michaels' lawyer. just received a telegram.
I credited him. It's all. It's totally is.
But here's the thing. It's all getting made here at Snell Studios. So, you know, all the money's flowing through the same coffers. Monty, have we any dead to bring out?
Well, I did have one. It is also a pirate movie. I like it a lot, but it is Yellowbeard, which is widely disliked. Briefly, for people who don't know Yellowbeard, it's a comedy pirate movie with Graham Chapman and Eric Idle and John Cleese from Monty Python, and also Peter Boyle and Madeline Kahn from the works of Mel Brooks, and also Peter Cook and Marty Feldman and Spike Milligan from the world of British comedy. And I would do it again with people also from different comedy worlds. I don't have anything past that, except I want Tim Robinson as the lead.
Noel Fielding. And throw Noel Fielding in there.
Oh, you got to hire some folks from the state.
Yeah. Sure. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. See?
Noel Fielding, Taika Waititi.
We fixed it. You know. Yellowbeard is a tremendous waste of incredible talent, and we can waste incredible talent again in the 21st century.
Absolutely.
Nick Kroll.
Cicero, any dead to bring out?
Yes, Moises.
Let's empty the big board, sir.
Right. The first carcass I want to throw onto the slab is the Matrix Resurrections. Those groans you hear are mine as well. What a waste of an opportunity that was. I also want to bring out a film called Silent Night. No, not that Silent Night. That's the 2002 TV movie starring Linda Hamilton. No. Not that Silent Night. That's the 2012 horror film. No. That's Silent Night, Deadly Night. That was a 1980s film.
That's what I was thinking of.
I'm, of course, talking about Silent Night, the 2023 John Woo film starring Joel Kinnaman From For All Mankind.
The RoboCop remake.
Yes,
and the RoboCop. Same character.
As the same character from RoboCop, except he says more in RoboCop. This film's premise was that it's a John Woo film where no one on screen says anything. And it works.
Nothing but talking. You want nothing but talking.
I just want a text adventure. Just give me, you've been swallowed by a gru. This film could have been so much more than it was, and it wasn't. And finally, any movie made by Roland Emmerich after Independence Day. Pick any of them. They're all the same film. The same movie.
Now I'm picturing Oregon Trail, the movie starring Joel Kinnaman. He blows someone away and goes, "You have died of dysentery."
Perfect. Perfect. That would work.
Emmerich's series of disaster-based movies built for theoretical sequels that never arrived. Lisa,
and all in the same universe.
Any dead to bring out?
The most flamboyant corpse of them all would be my proposed remake of Dungeons and Dragons Honor Among Thieves as an animated movie. Mostly because while it would be a shame to squander the prodigious on-screen charms of Chris Pine and Reg Jean Page, the special effects are flatly terrible. Some of the actors are just bleh. And I propose you make it animated. You're allowed to rotoscope it if you want, so we can see some of that, or we can see Hugh Grant's fantastic flamboyant performance, but this thing needs to look otherworldly and genuinely weird and slightly imaginary. It does not need to exist in the world of filmmaking as we know it now. So that's my first big proposed remake. The second one involves a time machine and going back to the late 1990s, where fresh off the success of Devil in a Blue Dress, Don Cheadle and Denzel Washington team up and say, "We're going to do a Superman and Batman team up movie together." Denzel plays Superman, Don Cheadle plays Batman, and they launch a franchise. That's my second Bring Out the Dead. Forget the rest of the 1990s Batman franchises. Don Cheadle is your caped cowl, your caped crusader, the dude in the cowl, Bruce Wayne millionaire with his good friend Clark Kent. They found the Justice League. Queen Latifah is allowed to play Alfred.
Well, related, I would love to see that the rest of the Devil in a Blue Dress series too.
Oh my God, wouldn't that be great? Mm-hmm. That was such a
we're
movie.
Remaking bad movies here. No, we're just remaking bad movies today.
I know.
We're gonna
know.
Fill out I'm the rest sorry. Of the Tangent. Snell Studios okay. schedule sidebar. Another day.
All right, so this, can I pick a Batman from the 90s and say I'm remaking it only? Yeah, I'm completely
yeah,
regretting
you're remaking
it.
Batman right. Forever, and it's and yeah. you threw Superman in, and it's Denzel yeah. and Cheadle.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. Yeah, thank you.
That works.
You.
That
you
works.
Get, you get
yeah,
me.
There we go. Mm-hmm. See, Lisa yeah. stays in the boundaries. David, don't take her off the track.
I took a
please.
Sidebar.
I was,
that's
I was
the
one who proposed He-Man, but make members. It wacky races. So for my part, just a couple of things here. Ice Pirates, just remake Ice Pirates, but good. That's a simple one. The Super Mario Brothers, the movie, from the 90s, because doubling, tripling down on that weird, strange conception of things, I think there's something interesting there. I would remake Kill and Kill Again with a $500 million budget.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another movie that we've covered on the show, Just Imagine, from 1930. It's public domain. We don't have to pay anybody for the rights. Nobody owns the rights. We can play with the wild, bizarre things that are in that cavalcade of weirdness and just go off the rails. And frankly, I would also remake, trash cinema classics, Star Raiders, The Howling Horror of Dracula, and Last Dance of the Devils with an apostrophe, which are truly the movies. Worst of the worst movies that really did actually get made. This has been a wonderful time. I feel like Snell Studios is looking at a new dawn as things are looking dire for other studios. I think we got a lot of bad movies that are going to be remade into good or at least profitable. Let's be honest. That's the only thing that matters these days. Series of films. Nothing remains but for me to thank our panelists. Cicero Holmes, thank you so much for bringing justice and webs to webs and justice today.
Thank you very much, Moises. The future is ours.
Monty Ashley, avast ye matey, the seas are safe again from crummy, crummy movies that tie in theme park rides as an excuse to cover up a perfectly good book.
To be clear, my movies are going to be so expensive, there's no way they'll make a profit.
Well, it's Jason's studio, not mine, so not like it's going to hurt my feelings. David, Jay Lore, thank you so much for bringing back Pulp, which, let's be clear, you've never brought back before.
Hey, no, not at all. And I would kind of like to say, can we just remake Coyote versus Acme exactly the way they made it so we can see it? I want to see that movie. No tax break nonsense.
Justice for Coyote versus Acme. Lisa Schmeiser, whether we're going on a heist or getting trashed out in the woods with superpowers, it feels like you are picking up what other people chose to put down, but not in the good way. You are elevating the comic book form in ways that has not been done in full-on years. Thank you.
Thank you. I had a great time on this podcast with you guys, and I am in awe of everyone's creativity here.
And again, I'm Moises Chuyan. We'll be back next week with another trip on the Incomparable Zeppelin. Thanks for listening.